Hello and welcome to the Why We Love podcast. My name's David.
And I'm Moxie.
And this week we are discussing the David Cronenberg film Maps to the Stars.
Yes, a bold choice, some might say. Maps to the Stars. I think, was it you that recommended we do this one, or was it me? I honestly can't remember.
I think you had said we should do a David Cronenberg one.
Right.
And Maps to the Stars, I remember being a film that I'd really, really enjoyed, but I couldn't remember much else apart from that.
Right. Yeah, I thought you had sort of good memories of it. Has that changed at all since you've rewatched it?
No, like I still like it.
Yes.
But since I've seen Maps to the Stars, which is like a satire on, like, you know, the toxic nature of
The Hollywood machine.
Yeah, exactly. And all the guff that surrounds that.
Yes.
I have since seen The Neon Demon.
Oh, do you know, I've been meaning to watch that for so long. And I nearly watched it the other night, but then something else took my fancy instead.
Oh, fair. It's so good. I think it's a satire on, like, the modelling industry.
Yes, yeah.
But it's so, like, slick and just beautiful looking.
Nice.
And the screenplay, I either imagine that it's like a 500-page Bible in which Nicholas Winding Refn has written down every aspect of every shot.
Yeah.
Or it's 5 pages because there's not that much dialogue at all.
Interesting. Yeah, I've heard really good things about The Neon Demon, and some of the screenshots that I've seen look incredible. Just for some reason, I haven't gotten around to it yet, but it's definitely one that I want to see.
It is.
And so, go on, sorry.
I was just going to say, it is very good, and I think it was that film that, like, cemented my just general, like, adoration for Elle Fanning.
Oh, yeah.
If she's in anything now, I'll watch it. And I think it was because of The Neon Demon.
I watched her in something that was really good, and I can't think off the top of my head what it was. But, yeah, she's an interesting actress. Sorry, I had a momentary lapse of brain function. So your opinion of Maps to the Stars hasn't changed. You still enjoy it.
Yeah, it's not like the most profound work of genius that I've seen because The Neon Demon came out, but
I see.
But my initial general opinion of it, I still enjoy it, so.
Okay, that's good. Just because our little preamble chat before the podcast, I was like, I don't know where you're gonna land on this. You were a little bit cryptic. But for anybody at home who hasn't seen the film, you should know that we're about to discuss it. So spoilers alert.
Oh, yeah.
And also, I should probably just mention that we, or I, will be discussing incest and sexual abuse. So if that's going to upset you, you may not want to listen to this episode. But there are some other episodes you can listen to that are a bit less triggering. So the story of Maps to the Stars, it's a little bit difficult to explain, isn't it?
Yeah. It's a bit of a web.
It is, isn't it? I mean, it's structured quite like a Greek tragedy, so you have to bear that in mind. And it's basically about, what, 4, 5, 6 characters? 5 characters. And how their lives intersect.
Yeah.
And so we have Julianne Moore as the very Lindsay Lohan in Crisis, like in her later years. realness, shall we say? Do you agree?
If
you imagine what Lindsay Lohan was like at her worst, no judgment, by the way, because I think she's probably a very nice girl. She's just, you know, Hollywood, to put it nicely. But at her worst, she was this sort of spoiled brat, kind of, you know, alcoholic, whatever, blah, blah, blah. And maybe it's just the red hair, I don't know. But Julianne Moore gives me strong Lindsay Lohan vibes.
I didn't make that comparison, but that is only because I don't know, because my interest in like celebrity culture is very limited. So,
oh, me too.
So I only like get the smallest drips. I don't know enough about Lindsay Lohan at her worst to comment.
I don't mean I just mean like the general perception of her. But to be perfectly honest, it's the same perception that Britney Spears has or any other young girl in the Hollywood or music industry.
Oh, right.
So no shade to Lindsay. Live your life, girl. it just gave me strong vibes of her. It's probably just the red hair and a bit of a petulant attitude that made me make that connection. But she's an actress in Hollywood who has a famous mother, and she's trying to live up to the same sort of acting legacy that her mother left behind. And she's kind of the main focus of the film, but like I say, it is five or six characters all sort of intersecting at once.
Yeah.
And then we have John Cusack. I have all the time in the world for him. I grew up thinking I'd probably marry him, and you know, I'm not bitter that it didn't happen, it's fine. But yes, I have all the time in the world for John Cusack. And even though he is so creepy as this bizarre self-help guru, masseur, whatever the fuck he is.
Quack.
Quack. He's fantastic in it.
Yeah, I really liked him in this. It's like kind of understated, but but when he like gets when it's the therapy sessions where he really gets going, but then he's delivering.
And it's a bit of a, you wouldn't expect to see John Cusack in a Cronenberg film.
No, that's
it's a different route for him. But as I say, he plays this like self-help guru who has this bizarre therapy. I suppose this is quite apt actually because of the body connection with Cronenberg. You know, he's got this big reputation as body horror, and Maps to the Stars is not body horror at all. But John Cusack's character, he's like a masseur, but he gets you to talk about your trauma whilst he's manipulating parts of your body.
Yeah.
And it's weird.
Yeah.
Very Hollywood. they'd make a fortune. I'm sure that's a real thing somewhere. Some actor is paying a fortune to cry about something while somebody, you know, touches him up.
I was going to say, it feels real. You know, there's like just some things that are too weird to be made up.
Yeah.
That feels like one of them.
Yeah, right? You can just imagine it. And it's during these therapy sessions that it's discovered that Julianne Moore's character, Vanna, is that it? I think it's Vanna.
Yeah.
That she was abused by her mother, the famous actress.
Yes.
which is very, you know, Mummy Dearest and the Anne Sexton thing of women abusers, which isn't often talked about, just as a FYI.
No, I was going to say, when I saw it in the cinema, when they started delving into that like part of it, I think I was surprised. I mean, it was a long time ago when I saw it in the cinema, but I do seem to remember being surprised that it was the mother doing the abuse rather than a male figure of some sort.
Yeah. It's just an interesting thing for them to have done, just in terms of, yeah, you don't hear about that so often. And if you do, it tends to be more violence as opposed to sexual abuse.
Yeah.
So that's an interesting little thing. But it also connects with this whole Greek tragedy thing that I mentioned earlier.
Yes, yeah.
Because, you know, in Greek mythology, Roman mythology, freaking, I don't know, Chinese mythology, every culture that has gods and goddesses and all these things, they all tend to have a myth where incest is involved. Particularly the Greeks and the Romans, it's really common. And usually, although not always, but usually, if there is an incestuous relationship within these myths, the children tend to be cursed in some way or another. And I really like that Cronenberg, or the guy who wrote this, whose name I have forgotten, but I like that they leaned into that.
It's
interesting. And then we've got Benji, this kid who's like 13. He's an actor, and he's John Cusack's son. And
he's vile.
He is vile. He's your typical spoiled, precocious kid actor. He's like 13. He's just come out of rehab, which is a red flag in itself. And of course, we meet his mother, who appears to be your typical stage mother.
Yeah.
Who doesn't necessarily have her kid's best interests at heart.
She's played by Olivia... Oh, God damn it. I had the name for a second. I don't know.
Olivia Williams.
That's the one. And I mean, Olivia Williams usually sports that particular haircut.
Yes.
But in the context, you can't help but think of Kris Jenner.
Oh, I had not, actually.
Oh, because when you're talking about just horrible, like, stage moms or...
Mm.
Yeah, she takes the biscuit and then some.
Yes. I mean, I don't know a hell of a lot about the Kardashians, but when it comes to their reputation, I blame the mum.
I was going to say, I don't know that much about them, but I read, like, I didn't do much research. I think I was bored and I read, like, a listicle on BuzzFeed.
Right.
About, like, fucked up stuff she'd done, and she's not great.
No. I mean, any parent that, you know, willingly signs away their children's image and gets them on TV and all the rest of it, I can't help but question that.
Yeah. I mean, thingy, what's she calling it? Kylie Jenner. I don't want to, like, speculate about the emotional well-being of, like, people I don't know, but there was an interview with her in a magazine that I read and it was, there was a reason I read it, and it wasn't that I was interested, it was just there was a bit in it, and this like passage has stuck with me since uni, so that's like about 3 or 4 years, because it's just haunting, which is, she's talking about the decor of her house, and she said growing up, because they were on TV and all that, and they're really close as a family, the other sisters and the mum had controlled everything to do with her image, so they all went for like bright colours and this and that. So in the house she owns now, where she could have complete control with what it looked like, it was like painted, all of it, military grey.
Whoa.
Because it was the only like thing that, like, the only colour that was like hers.
Hers, yeah.
Yeah, it's just like, Christ, that's
dark.
Terrifying. Yeah. Oh,
dear. Yeah, like I say, I really don't know much about them. I probably could name all of them if I had to, but
oh, go on, yeah. That'll be a fun diversion.
Kylie.
Yeah.
Hang on. With you know, the one with the bum, married to Kanye West. Kim, there we go. Kim, Kylie, Kim, Kendall. Wait, I can totally do this, because they did that song on Drag Race, didn't they, where they played the Kardashians. Don't know if you know about that. So if I sing the song to myself, I can probably do this. How many of them are there?
Five.
Oh, Christ. Okay. Kylie, Kim, Kendall. Black China's not a Kardashian, right?
No.
Damn. Two more. What names begin with K? Chris? No, that's the mum, isn't it?
Yeah, that's if it helps, one of them, even though the name begins with a K, it's a name that doesn't usually begin with a K, if that helps.
I know I'll know it when you say it. No. Go on. Who are the other two?
Kendall.
I said Kendall, didn't
Did
I?
You? No, sorry. Oh, fucking hell.
I named three. I said Kim, Kylie, and Kendall.
Kim, Kylie, and Kendall. Right, so Chloe.
Oh, shit. Chloe, of course.
That's the one with the stupid spelling of a name.
Right.
And the other one. Oh, this is hurting me. Why am I trying to remember this?
Let's Google it.
Oh, God. Kim, Chloe, and... Oh, God, this is going to kill me when you say it as well.
Let's have a look-see here.
Courtney!
You got it. Just as Google went ping!
Yes!
Yeah, Courtney, of course. See, I knew them if you say them.
Oh, and that's a stupid spelling of the name as well. Fuck.
Actually, I don't mind the spelling of Chloe with a K-H. That's not so bad, but honestly, give the K thing up. It's so narcissistic. But anyway, that was a strange detour we took there.
Oh, it was.
I had not made the link at all between her and the mum, Chris Jenner.
I mean, it's a bit of a reach, but I was like, well...
No, I can see it with the hair. Now that you've said it, I'm like, oh, yeah. I feel so stupid.
The fact that you don't know anything about them speaks to your high intelligence.
I wouldn't go that far, but okay, I'll take it. I'll take it. So where was I? Yes, we meet Benji, the teenage boy. He's a superstar, 13, just come out of rehab. And we meet Agatha, next, played by, and I'm going to murder her name, and I'm so sorry. Hopefully you'll know how to pronounce this properly, but is it Mia Wasikowska? No, it's not Wasikowska. It's Wasikowska? Oh, damn. I'm so sorry to anybody who knows how to pronounce this name. Wasikowska. That's not how you say it. I know that's not how you say it, but I'm just reading it off Google.
The way I've been saying it for years, and this is purely based on how Mark Kermode pronounces it, so it may not be 100%.
He's exactly why I was like, that's not how you say it, because yeah. That's not how Mark Kermode says it.
Yeah, he says it as Wasikowska.
There we go. And there we go. I'm sure that's probably right.
And that's just how I've been pronouncing it since, so...
Well, Mia, she plays Agatha, a mysterious character with burns on the side of her face. Oh, that was such an easy entrance for a Clue reference. I don't know if you're familiar with the film Clue.
I've heard of it. It's a film based on Cluedo.
Oh, David, what have you been doing with your life? If you've never seen Clue, you have not lived, my friend. That's like... Oh, that is like self-care 101. It's fantastic. But for anybody at home who's listening to this, who's also a Clue fan, I said burns on the side of her face. Flames. Breathing. Heavy. Doesn't matter.
Is Scarlett in the library with the wrench?
There you go. You're trying. That's good. Honestly, though, watch Clue.
Okay.
What have you been doing with your life? That's outrageous. Outrageous. There are some things I will forgive when it comes to film, but that is outrageous. Anyway, back to Mia.
Yeah.
How does he say it?
Wasikowska.
Wasikowska.
Yeah.
Wasikowska. Mia Wasikowska. Okay, Mia. She's this mysterious character with burns on her face. And she is employed by Julianne Moore's character. Why did I want to make that point? Oh, yes. the reason I bring up her being employed by Julianne Moore is because we get a stellar cameo from Carrie Fisher in Maps to the Stars.
Yes. Yeah. I forgot she turned up in it.
Me too.
Yeah.
And I'm just always happy when I see her pop up in something. Rest in peace, Carrie.
Oh god, yeah, this is another...
It is, isn't it? Why are we always talking about dead... Well, that is kind of my life, talking about dead people. But anyway, yes, Carrie Fisher. Always a pleasure to see her on the screen.
Yeah.
And I like that she was playing herself.
Yeah, that was fun.
That was
kind
of cool. I like that. So anyway, Agatha is employed by Julianne Moore's character. And so we start to see these connections come together, why these five people are linked. We discover that Agatha is Benji, the young superstar actor, that she is his sister. And there's a strange backstory there that isn't really fully discussed. It's kind of... I'd say it's more than implied. It is said that Agatha is schizophrenic and that she was kind of obsessed with her little brother and wanted to marry him.
Yes.
And one night she gave Benji a bunch of sleeping pills to knock him out and set the house on fire.
Yeah.
So obviously Agatha has become estranged from her parents, who are, you know, John Cusack and Olivia Williams.
Yeah.
So we're starting to see connections. It's all starting to make a little bit of sense. You're still not sure where the story's going because things are happening all the time and it's Cronenberg, so you never really know quite what to expect. Also, just a little tidbit, if you will. It turns out, I mean, I did kind of notice it while I was watching it, but the more that Agatha reveals of herself and her history, the more visible her scars become.
See, now I thought that was just, like, that was just a thing with me. I didn't think it was, like, a thing done in the film. I just thought it was me, like...
noticing more.
Yeah, like, oh, yeah, she is, but I didn't think that was a...
Well, perhaps I'm what's the expression? You know, pulling at straws or whatever. But I did think there were a couple of times when her scars became more noticeable, and I wondered, is that a thing, or is it just the fact that the camera is slightly more to the left, so we're seeing more of the scar? I mean, do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean, it is directed by David Cronenberg, so it would not surprise me if it was intentional.
Well, that's what I kept thinking, like, it's Cronenberg, though. And it wasn't just on her face that, like, really, towards the end, you saw parts of, like, her back, and you could see some of the scarring running down her back.
Oh, yeah, when she's putting the dress on.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I thought that was kind of interesting, and, you know, if it was intentional, which I kind of think it is, it was a cool thing to do.
Yeah.
A sort of subtext. I feel like this is really unstructured, what I'm saying right now. But the film is fairly unstructured, so please don't judge me too harshly. what else? Oh, right, so... Oh, no, go on, were you going to say something?
Oh, I was just going to say, I've got, like, one's... just some trivia on one of the actors, the others just mentioning an actor in general. So.
Uh-huh.
So the bit of trivia is Julianne Moore's mom, Julianne Moore's character's mom,
yeah,
is played by Sarah Gadon, who's a Canadian actress, I think, and she, like, first entered the Cronenberg world, and I hope I'm getting the chronology this right, by appearing in a film called Antiviral.
Oh, yes, yes, that's Cronenberg's son's film, isn't it?
Yeah, Brandon Cronenberg.
That's him, yeah.
Which is an incredibly fucked film.
It is, but I did like it.
Oh, no, it's great. I have it on DVD right next to Maps of the Stars and Cosmopolis. So,
nice.
And yeah, so she was in that, and then she was in Cosmopolis, playing the wife of Robert Pattinson, who appears in this film.
Yeah, there's a connection, isn't there?
Yeah, I like Robert Pattinson.
I don't really have any strong feelings about him. I'm interested to see his Batman.
Oh, yeah, me.
I think he could probably do that quite well. But, yeah, he's all right. And he's in Maps to the Stars, as you just say. As a kind of... I don't know, he's not one of the main cast, but he does play a pretty significant role.
Yeah.
In terms of being a catalyst, I would say.
Yeah.
So, at some point in the film, we're coming back to the Greek tragedy thing again.
Yeah.
It turns out that the characters that John Cusack and Olivia Williams play, that they are brother and sister.
Yeah.
And she mentions at some point that they had been separated, sort of raised separately.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Which again ties into the whole Greek tragedy myths thing. Because there are a couple of those where somebody is told your son is going to do such and such. And so the parent sends the child away somewhere to stop that thing from happening. But it turns out that by separating them, they've actually caused the thing that they were trying to avoid.
Yes, that's Oedipus.
Yes, thank you, Oedipus. And there are a couple of other ones where, I can't think which one it is, but there's one with a brother and sister, I swear. Or no, maybe it's... No, maybe it's something else. It doesn't matter. The themes are the same. I just thought it was interesting that they threw that in there, that they had been, you know, I don't know if it was separated at birth or at what point, but she does say that they were raised separately, or words to that effect.
Yeah.
Which I just think is a really, yeah, just a really cool way of tying it into this tragedy satire.
Yeah.
Whatever you want to call Maps to the Stars. What else? So yes, Agatha is employed by Julianne Moore's character, and a lot of stuff goes down, but essentially Agatha murders Julianne Moore's character.
Yes.
In quite a delightful way.
It's very, like, visceral.
It is, isn't it? And it's so on the nose that it's an award
yeah.
that Agatha uses as her murder weapon. I believe it's actually Cronenberg's award from, I'm not sure which one of the film festival type things, but it is one of his awards that she uses to bash in Julianne Moore's head and face. And I just think that's such a perfect image for Hollywood. Your success will kill you.
Oh, that's very poignant. I hadn't picked up on that.
I again, maybe I'm just picking at straws here, but I feel like that is definitely a comment on Hollywood's gonna kill you. Like, that's just how the game is played. It will use you up and spit you out, and it's not a very kind look at Hollywood.
No, it's, yeah, it's very, very bleak.
It is, but I like it. I think there's so much going on in it. It's quite a hard film to discuss, really. Just because there's quite a lot of subtext, and it's such a dense film, but it appears fairly simple.
Yeah,
that idea of like a group of people whose lives interconnect and whatever appears to be, on the face of it, fairly simple, but it's not. So, it's a ride. One that I enjoy. I mean, I like Cronenberg stuff a lot. And this one's quite a different sort of Cronenberg.
Yeah. I like Cronenberg for the most part, I think, but some of his films that I do not care for at all.
Oh, really? Like what?
Let me try and remember their names now.
Is it like his earlier stuff, like Shivers and Rabid, that sort of stuff?
No, that strikes me as stuff I'd like, I just haven't seen them.
Right.
A Dangerous Method.
I haven't seen that one.
Fuck me, that... Just, I have never lost patience with a film so quick in my life.
No, really?
Yeah, It's got like, I mean, it's about Freud and Jung, and it.
Right.
And so there's, Freud is played by Viggo Mortensen, I think that's how you pronounce it, and Jung is played by Michael Fassbender.
Fassbender, and Keira Knightley.
Yes. Now, Viggo Mortensen and Michael Fassbender do perfectly solid performances. Uh-huh. Keira Knightley does the most exasperating performance I've ever seen. It's not that she's bad, because it's not like, but it takes me out of the film, but not because she's acting badly. It's just the character that she's. It's a performance that just annoys me. I can't.
How interesting.
And the other, I think there's, and the other two. Mm-hmm. And I think they're both Cronenberg. I hope they are. But is Eastern Promises?
Yeah.
Don't like that. And I think that's Cronenberg.
Yes, it
and,
is.
And History of Violence.
Right.
Don't like that.
I haven't actually seen A History of Violence. I have seen Eastern Promises. And I thought it was okay. I didn't love it. I know a lot of people did. I thought it was fine. A History of Violence, to be honest, even though it's Cronenberg, whenever I read the synopsis, the plot, whatever, it just turned me off. I was like, I don't care. Literally, I don't care about any of this. Why would I want to watch this if I'm not interested? So, and that's kind of how I am with films. I'm not going to watch something just because it's the latest thing out and everybody loves it. It needs to interest me.
Yeah, fair.
Like I said, I'm getting old. Old and set in my ways. The talkies.
There was a Cronenberg film I was very close to disliking was Cosmopolis.
I can see why.
Because the story of me getting into that film is so odd, because the choice I make, like, my decisions do not make sense. So I found the DVD for Cosmopolis in a charity shop and I was like, a quid, great. So I went out and I put it on, and within the first 10 minutes, now I love the trailer, I think the trailer's spectacularly done. Mm-hmm. And in the first 10 minutes of the film, I was like, this is actually sending me to sleep.
Oh no.
So I took it out, put it back in its case, put the case in the box, and just left it. Then, about 3 months later, it was the Hay on Wye Literary Festival.
Uh-huh.
Right, which like I go to every year with my family, and we went there, and there's an old cinema there, which they converted into a bookshop, and they have
cool.
all manner of stuff there. And tucked away in a corner, they had like lots of copies of the novella Cosmopolis with the film cover.
Right.
And I was like, oh, this is cheap. And this is a film that I couldn't be fucked to watch. I will buy the book and read that instead.
Fair enough.
So I bought a book of a film that had put me to sleep. And I read it. And it was just fascinating. I loved every second of it. And once I'd finished reading the book, I put the film on and I watched the film all the way through and was just gripped by it, because it's such an exact adaptation. It's like,
how interesting.
Like, every line of dialogue is just lifted and put in the film. And it's really, really good.
That's a really interesting story there. Like, that, you would find it essentially boring.
Yeah.
The first time you stuck it on. But then you were still intrigued by it enough to buy the book.
Yeah.
And then you loved the book, and then you watched the film again, and you loved the film. That's a cool little cycle of discovery.
Yeah. But yeah, and I still have the film on DVD, because I do like it a lot.
You like it now.
yeah, I like it now.
Interesting. There are a few Cronenberg films that, to be perfectly honest, the ones I've seen, I really like. And it's only because I've not been interested in the storyline that I haven't watched some of his other stuff. So obviously, you know, I've seen, you know, Videodrome and The Fly and Scanners and The Brood and Crash and all these different things. And they're all fantastic.
Have you seen Existence?
Do you know what? I saw it when it came out, but I haven't seen it since. And I was saying to my husband, we should rewatch it because I remember really liking it at the time. And I just wonder how it's aged.
It's very good, and it's the first one, the first Cronenberg film I saw.
I think,
and at college we got shown it because I think like the modules were meant to take up a certain amount of days or whatever, and we'd actually finish the module early, so it was kind of last day of term thing. So it was like, okay, we're putting a film on, have fun. Okay. And the teacher put on Existenz, and he said, imagine a Christopher Nolan film, but good. I was like, hey. I was like, hey, what are you saying? And he goes, trust me, watch the film, and then you'll get what I mean. And I watched it, and I was like, oh my god, this is Inception, but like, it came first, and it's gross, and it has Jude Law in, so therefore better. So,
and Jennifer Jason Leigh.
And Jennifer Jason Leigh, yes.
Who I think's fantastic. Yeah, I should watch that one again, because I do remember really enjoying it, but that was like 20 years ago or something, so I really should give it another go.
It's a fun, gross.
Yeah. Well, that's kind of what you're looking for with Cronenberg, isn't it? Gross, I mean, me out. Yeah. Make it fun. although, you know, things like The Fly end up turning into this awful tragedy that just makes you feel all these things. I love The Fly so much. It's such a... Oh, that ending. It's such a heartbreak. Like, oh, emotion. Go on.
I was just gonna say, I will watch anything that has Jeff Goldblum in it. it's the law.
Yeah, kind of is. Yeah, I was gonna say The Brood came to mind when I was watching Maps to the Stars, only in terms of so Cronenberg is known for body horror, as we said. And the weird therapy that John Cusack is administering to Juliette Moore, this strange manipulation of muscles and, you know, really touching the body whilst she's reliving her trauma and talking about, you know, all these terrible things that have happened to her. There's a weird little connection there, I think, between The Brood and the therapies that go on in that film with what he's doing. Does that make sense? I don't know if you've seen The Brood.
I was going to say it'd make more sense if I'd seen The Brood. I haven't actually seen that.
Okay, well, all you need to know is that in terms of body horror, it is right up there.
Like
number one. In a brilliant way. I love The Brood. It's one of my, like, I don't know, top 10. Not that I ever choose a top 10, but it's just so fucking good.
Is that one where the cover, it's like someone slumped in a lift?
No, I think you're thinking of... I want to say Rabid, but I don't know that it's one of his earlier ones.
Yeah.
The Brood has Oliver Reed in it. Who's always worth watching, in my opinion. And it's kind of the story of a guy whose wife has gone off to this retreat with a similar sort of self-help guru who wants you to externalize your trauma.
Oh, right, okay.
And I don't want to spoil it for you or anybody else at home who hasn't seen The Brood, but it is excellent. Like, when you think of films like Don't Look Now and The Omen and, you know, proper classic horror from the 70s, The Brood is up there.
Okay.
I love it. It's fantastic. And I just thought there was something interesting there. I can't remember what they call the therapy in The Brood. It's got a name, but it's essentially like a physical manifestation of your emotions.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, when he's applying these therapies to Julianne Moore in her underwear, I might add.
she is.
Which does add a big layer of, what is going on here? It feels very sexual, even though it's not.
Yeah. I mean, there are a few things less sexy than an angry John Cusack shouting at you and rubbing your arm.
Yeah. Yeah, it's weird. It's just weird. But I do think there's a bit of a connection there between the sort of hands-on therapy and this expression of trauma and emotion and whatnot. It's something that I suppose runs through a few of his films as a theme.
Yeah.
So, basically, I really like Maps to the Stars. That's the long and the short of it. I really like it. It's weird. It touches on themes that I find interesting. And I always enjoy a satire of Hollywood because it's ripe for it. I just think it's a really interesting film.
I do really like it. It's kind of annoying that it's like a film that's hard to talk about.
Yes.
Because I do really like it, but there's... when I talk about it, it does boil down to me going, oh, that was good, weren't it?
Yes, it's hard to... With some films, I struggle to articulate why I like it.
Yeah. I was just going to say, with some films, it's like, it's really easy to grasp onto why you like a film. Which is why, being a fan of the Fast and Furious franchise, it's easy to say why you like them, because every film has a big gimmick. So that's...
I like how you've just sneakily crowbarred in some Fast and Furious there. That was sneaky.
But it is, because that's a film, if someone goes, why do you like Fast and Furious 5? It's easy. You can go, well, they drag a safe down a motorway, and The Rock pretends he's reading something, but you know that is actually the script and he's just reading his lines off a piece of paper. It's great. So, but yeah. Something like Maps to the Stars, where you actually have to, like, you know, think. It's so hard to, like, articulate and unpack.
It's a cerebral film, not to sound too pretentious. But
that's fine. That's it is.
Do you know what I mean? Like, like you said, you have to switch your brain on. You have to pay attention. You can't look away at your phone for 5 minutes. You've really got to be in it. And I think if you go into it that way, then, you know, you're either in for the ride or you're not.
Yeah.
There's going to be a point in the film where you go, oh, nothing's happening. I'm out. Or you're going to go, where is this going? Because this is Cronenberg and I don't trust him. It all seems very nice and very okay, but then slowly the layers are peeled away and you're left with essentially a bunch of horrible people who do horrible things.
I can't trust anyone who, at the age of, now he must have been 50 plus. So he was a fully conscious adult. I do not trust anyone who went, yeah, I'll do a cameo in Jason X. I cannot trust someone who does that.
I'd forgotten about that.
Oh, I hadn't.
It's been a long time since I watched Jason X, so I had forgotten that that even happened.
And more power to you, I watched it 3 weeks ago. So.
I'm surprised I didn't get round to it, because I did do a bit of a Friday the 13th like marathon not long ago, but I must have given up at some point and gone, do you know what, enough's enough.
I've watched in that my Friday the 13th track record's horrible, because I've watched the remake, Friday the 13th Part 6, Freddy vs. Jason, and Jason X. Those are the only Friday the 13th films I've seen.
I mean, I would say that's a jagged timeline there, but to be fair, it's a pretty jagged timeline anyway, I think. Interesting. Yeah, I had totally forgotten that he did that. Has he popped up in anything else?
If like, he has, I can't think of anything.
Right.
Certainly nothing I've seen, anyway.
Yeah. Interesting. Interesting. Went a bit Russian there. Interesting.
There's three things, or three notable things, about Maps of the Stars, which mm-hmm. I can... Which one, I love a lot, and two, I don't like. So I'll do the two I don't like first, just because they're easier to get out of the way.
Sure.
One, they kill the adorable dog.
I know.
I was hated
furious.
That dog is so cute.
As a dog lover and dog owner, I hate it when there's violence against an animal in a movie. It's so unnecessary. And I had forgotten that that happened. And then as soon as the dog entered the frame, I was like, oh no, I remember what happens. Oh no. Awful. Awful.
Yeah, like, as soon as they start playing around with the gun, I was like, oh.
Yep.
That dog.
Not cool. Not yeah. cool.
Wow. Love that dog. So I didn't like that, but that's fine, because part, well, no, it's not fine, but like part of the narrative, that's mm-hmm. just a bit of the story I don't like. There's yeah. this bit is like a weird technical thing, but considering how good everything else in the film looks, I was surprised at how not good this bit was, which is where Olivia Williams sets herself on fire.
Yeah, the graphics weren't the that graphics. The whatever. How old am I? yeah, like it was a little bit cheap and nasty.
It's one of like the worst like CGI fire I've seen.
I mean, I have to assume it's budgetary like restrictions that, you know, are behind that.
Yeah, I mean, like, you know, you have to work with what you've given. It only stood out because the rest of the film was like so.
Yeah.
But then again, the rest of the film was like low tech anyway, because I suppose because there was nothing out of the ordinary. Like most of the budget would have probably gone on Mia Wasikowska's bird makeup. So.
Could be. But, I'm just looking at the budget for it. Right now, it was 13 million, which is quite a small budget.
Yeah.
In Hollywood terms. It sounds crazy to say out loud, but it's true. And bearing in mind, out of that budget comes the star's salary.
That is true.
And Julianne Moore is, you know, I want to say she's Oscar nominated. I don't know that she won. Maybe I have that wrong. But
She was nominated for Still Alice, wasn't she?
Which I was thinking of The Hours, but perhaps you're right.
I think it was for... I think, well, she may have had been nominated for the Hours. I haven't seen that, so I don't know.
Right.
But I think she was for Still Alice, and I can't remember if she won or not. But that was a film that came after this, so...
Yeah. But she's still a you know, high-profile A-list actress. And then you've got Patterson, who was coming off... Or was he still doing Twilight? I don't really know.
No, this was... The reason I like Robert Pattinson and is... I mean, I... No, I don't hate the entirety of Twilight. I hate the first Twilight film.
Okay.
The second, third, and the fourth, part one and part two, are fine. And anytime Michael Sheen's on screen, it just shines. But after that, he started doing, like, appearing in these, like, little, like, weird roles. And it's just like, God, he's doing, like, interesting stuff now. Which is why I've taken notice of him. Someone who's done that to a more noticeable degree is Daniel Radcliffe.
Yes, absolutely.
I mean, whether you like the Harry Potter films or not, that's, you know, I like them, but, you know, I prefer the books. That, you know, I'm, that's the sort of person I am. But since then, the films he's done, he just... I mean, not all of them are going to be winners just because the amount he's done, but they're all so varied in, like, what they're about.
Yeah, absolutely. It will surprise no one that I am not a fan of Harry Potter, books or films.
Oh, that's okay, cool.
But that is purely because, again, I was too fucking old. By the time that, I mean, the first film came out in, I don't know, like 2002 or one, maybe? It was early 2000s, right?
I think so. That sounds right.
Yeah. So I'm like in my early 20s. I've never heard of Harry Potter before, the movie. Because I never, I mean, I've always been a reader, but I never particularly read children's fiction, if that kind of makes sense. I've kind of been reading, I suppose, oh god, that makes me sound so fucking pretentious, doesn't it? But
I can't wait for this.
I just mean that I was reading adult books as a child, you know. I'm not trying to be a douchebag about it, I'm really, really not, because there are some amazing kids books out there, but generally speaking, as a young girl, I wasn't reading, you know, Nancy Drew or something else aimed at children. And so, yeah, Potter never crossed my radar at all. And then the films came out and everybody was raving about them, and I watched one and went, okay, that was fine. Didn't hate it, didn't love it. Yeah, that was fine. And then it just became this juggernaut of Potter people everywhere. Yeah. Everyone talked about Harry Potter, and they told me it was dark. Oh, they lied. They said, oh, it's dark. Oh, it is. Oh, Moxie, let me tell you, it's so dark, and this happens, and that happens, and... I haven't got time for people who think that Harry Potter is, ooh, dark. Like...
I mean, I try and stay away from fandoms of certain things. I just can't be dealing with them.
Yes.
Like, well, in terms of, go on, I'm gonna try and like try and piss off everyone who likes certain types of media. So, Five Nights at Freddy's, love the games, can't be fucked with that fandom. Ever since they got horny over a fucking robot chicken, so that's them. Harry Potter, can't be doing with it. I like the books, the films are tolerable, but fuck me sideways, I do not need to know the minutiae that those people do. I don't care if wizards walking up and downstairs shitting themselves. Don't care. It's not for me.
What is that? I mean, there's a lot to unpack when it comes to Harry Potter. And J.K. Rowling. I mean, at the moment, she is public enemy number one. And in my opinion, such as it is, rightly fucking so, She's become this awful, like a lot of celebrities at the moment, she's become this strange... There's no other way to put it. She's a trans-exclusionary radical feminist.
Yeah.
Or TERF, to you and me.
Yeah.
And I know a lot of people think that's a slur. It's not. Get over it.
Yeah.
No. So, yes, she's been stirring up shit. And is starting to actually see the repercussions of it, which I'm fine with.
Yeah. I mean, like...
If you're going to say bigoted stuff or prejudiced stuff, you're going to get pushback. And you should get pushback. Because what you're saying is incorrect.
It's what I found... And I found it kind of funny as well. And it not the JK Rowling thing. It was like a response to a JK Rowling thing. It amused me slightly because... She had said in defense of what she was saying that it was because she'd been sexually assaulted or abused.
I think it's both.
Oh, both, right. Which, you know, isn't an excuse for saying X, Y, Z.
Oh, absolutely not, no.
But it's like domestic abuse is still a thing that should be like talked about and addressed.
Absolutely.
And I love that Stephen King... tweeted that
yes.
It should be talked about, and she like did this really like nauseatingly like simpering tweet going, oh thank you Stephen King, I love you so much, and then someone tweeted Stephen King going, so because you've tweeted saying you support JK Rowling talking about sexual abuse etc, what are your thoughts on this whole issue? And he just responded with trans women are women, and just left
epic.
It. And I was like, okay, that is beautiful. Like,
it was a goddamn mic drop. Now, Stephen King has said some iffy stuff from time to time, but yes, I was pleased as punch to see him say trans women are women.
Yeah.
There aren't enough celebrities who will say it as simply as that.
Yeah. I mean, he's said some dodgy stuff, he's written some dodgy stuff as well.
Oh, so absolutely.
I love that. What is it? The Tommyknockers? I mean, I haven't read that, but I love the fact that he just goes, I don't remember writing it. I was on so much cocaine, and I've read it since, and I hate it.
Yeah, it's understandable. It's not a great book. but he did write some corkers while he was, high as a kite. As messed up and problematic as some of them are, they are still an excellent read.
Yeah.
If you can get past, you know, some of the stuff that's in there, which, to be fair, is, I mean, I'm thinking of one book in particular. I think it's Rose Matter. It is a genuinely hard read. It's full of racism and domestic violence in graphic detail.
I haven't read it, but it's the one book of his that my mom hates.
Like, I don't blame her.
She's like the biggest Stephen King fan, and like half her bookshelves are just taken up with like everything he's written. But when she came to sorting out bookshelves, Rose Matter in the bin straight away.
Wow, it's a hard read. It's not a nice read, but there's something about and this kind of ties in nicely because it's about mythology. There's a really nice. Or maybe not nice is the right word, a really interesting part of the book that involves a minotaur and a maze, and the imagery and the way that she interacts with it, I just found really interesting and very cool. But sadly, the rest of the book is pretty vile in terms of graphic racism and graphic domestic abuse. That said, I don't think that he endorses any of that behaviour.
No.
Just because you write a character who is racist doesn't make you racist.
Yeah.
But that said, it's, you know, if I was reading that book and I was a woman of colour, I'd be a bit, you know, why is this white guy saying all this terrible shit?
Yeah.
but such as it is, it's problematic, but it is a book I've read more than once, so make of that what you will.
Right, okay.
The broken and bitter Moxie. Finding solace in tales of woe.
Shall we drift back to...
Yes, we probably should. Otherwise, I'm going to start ranting again about J.K. Rowling and Potter people. No offense, by the way. I briefly forgot that we were doing a podcast and not just chatting. So apologies to people who are listening who love Harry Potter. I am glad that you have it in your life. It sucks that the person wrote it has turned into this awful, awful creature.
To be honest, I think... And this is certainly my... I mean, I've never considered myself a Potter person particularly. But I think even now, like, the most diehard Harry Potter fans have been turned off because of the Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them trilogy. Well, I think it's a trilogy.
Yeah.
Because the second one, which... Granted, I mean, I preferred the second Fantastic Beasts film to the first one purely because it actually had a discernible storyline. People, like diehard Harry Potter fans, hated because it's just littered with continuity errors.
Yeah,
but she wrote the books that have the continuity in it, and she wrote the script for the film, which then had the errors in it. So. I was like, look, you're fucking up your own work here. I don't care.
So in step with who she is, though. I mean, with her retroactive admissions of LGBTQ characters in her books.
Oh, yeah.
Like coming out and saying Dumbledore's gay, by the way. And it's like, no, you can't do that. You can't do that. It has to be in the text somewhere. Yeah. Whether it's subtext or it's explicit, you need to have it in there. Otherwise, he doesn't count, in my mind, as an LGBTQ character. You can't retroactively say, oh, yeah, well, I had it in mind that he was gay. Well, big deal. You need to be either explicit or put it in a subtext, whatever. There needs to be something in there. You can't just take a character out of a bag and say, oh, well, yeah, I'm diverse because Dumbledore's gay. It's, yeah. I'm ranting.
Okay.
And we need to get back on course, otherwise who knows where and when this podcast will end.
Shall I say the one bit of Maps of the Stars that I really, really liked?
Yes.
Cool. And then I think I'll be able to juice unless you say anything that I can like bounce off. Okay. The bit I really liked was, and it was played in all the trailers, and when it happened in the film, it really stays with you, where Julianne Moore was on the phone.
Yeah.
And then she just dashes it off the floor and screams. I just love that because there's no dramatic music, there's just nothing apart from... Yeah. The sound that's in the world and her screaming, and it's so that just cuts through you like a knife.
It does, doesn't it? And it's such a an emotional and powerful scream, you know? Like, you really do feel like she's just letting it all out.
Yeah.
Yeah, I really like that bit too. I'd forgotten it was in the trailers. You're like a trailer... genie, you remember all these trailers. I barely remember. Yes, I really liked that bit, and I actually quite enjoyed, and in my defense, you are meant to laugh a little uncomfortably when Julianne Moore starts singing and dancing because an actress has pulled out of a film that she wanted to take the role of. But her son died in a pool accident.
Oh, and God, Julie yeah.
Moore is tickled pink that this kid is dead. And so the mother can't do the role and that she'll be up for the part. And yeah, she's just singing and dancing in the garden. And it just made me laugh, and I was like, that's so dark and I like it.
Yeah.
I know I shouldn't, but this bitch is unraveling. Yeah, crazy. But I really enjoyed that. To be fair, I don't think there's much that I didn't really like about it. I mean, like you said, the bit where the dog is shot, I don't like that, especially. But otherwise, I don't think there's anything else in it that really stands out as something I don't like.
No, same here. I mean, I was reaching when I went, oh, the fire looks a bit crap, so...
Yeah. No, it's true, though. Yeah, it's true. It does stand out just because it looks pretty bad. But, you know, it's what, 2 minutes of footage? You know, I can live with... If I can live with the Mummy Returns CGI... I can live with some crappy fire effects.
Yeah. Ooh. God, I forgot about The Mummy Returns.
I mean, it's shocking. But the film is brilliant, so it's fine.
Hold on, which film? The Mummy Returns?
Yes.
Oh, I do like The Mummy Returns.
I like The Mummy and I like The Mummy Returns.
Yeah,
both
same here.
Are excellent. But and actually, weirdly, the CGI in the first film, I think, is better than the CGI in the second film.
Well, yeah, because they haven't tried to recreate the...
Oh, I suppose, yeah.
The awe-inspiring visage of Dwayne The Rock Johnson.
The Scorpion King. God, it's dreadful. And it was dreadful at the time. But, yeah, I'll forgive it because I like the film.
It's amazing because there's better CGI in the same film.
There's better CGI in, like, I was going to say in the original Star Wars, but that sounds like I'm sort of dissing it in a way, and I'm not. I just mean, like, yeah, there's been better special effects. I don't know quite what went wrong with that one.
Yeah, but...
And I'm surprised it hasn't... Oh, no, go on.
Oh, no, I was like, well, hold on. I was trying to think, well, I've pissed off Harry Potter fans. I've pissed off Five Nights at Freddy's fans. So now I'm going to go for the Star Wars fans again and say that the CGI rock in The Mummy Returns is on a par with the CGI Peter Cushing in Rogue One. Just gonna throw that out there because it's fucking shite.
Oh, controversial. In which one was it? Rogue One.
I
watched that once. I didn't really like Rogue One.
Yes.
I've been meaning to watch it again, but I just didn't really enjoy it, so nothing's pulling me back. But I don't remember it being shocking. Having said that, the Princess Leia that they created for the end of... Oh, hang on, that's the same one, isn't it? Rogue One, which turns up at the end. Yeah, that was a wee bit...
Oh, that's very creepy. That's very off-putting.
Yeah, there's a bit of an uncanny valley thing going on there. Because it doesn't look bad. It doesn't not look like her. It does look like her, but there's something, just something off that draws your attention.
What I think it is as well with a lot of Uncanny Valley stuff is mouths.
Oh, like, really? I always think of it as the eyes. There's something wrong with the eyes.
Well, I think now they've got the eyes kind of like okay. It's all, like when I notice a fuck up, it's usually... the mouth area.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, God, this is so off topic, but at the moment I'm playing Detroit Become Human on my laptop, and the graphics are gorgeous. But every time one of the characters looks off, it's always because of, like, a mouth movement.
Right.
So, but, yeah.
Okay. I'm always focused on the eyes, but I think you're right. When I think back, it is sometimes there is a bit of a mouth issue. It must be so hard to do.
No doubt.
I don't quite know how they all pull it together these days, but it's crazy. But it does feel like I've seen some excellent, like, What am I thinking of? Ant-Man? With Michael Douglas, and they made him younger, and it was spooky.
Yeah, that was good.
That was so well done. And I think, did they do the same thing to Kurt Russell in the Guardians of the Galaxy 1?
Well, if you ask anyone who's seen the film, they say yes. If you ask Kurt Russell, he says, no, that's me as I am now. They just put a bit of makeup on.
Righto. who are we trying to fool here, Kurt?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. yeah, so I've there's some really good CGI out there, but for me personally, I think that CGI works best when it's locations and scenery and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
I'm not wild about, like, for example, The Irishman. It was a great film, but I didn't really care about the graphics too much. It wasn't so good that I lost myself in it. I was always very aware that I was watching CGI stuff going on.
Yeah.
The
thing I've heard about that is that it's a load of 40-year-old men moving around like 60-year-old men. That's the...
Yeah. That's pretty much it. I mean, don't get me wrong, I did really enjoy it. I didn't love it like I was expecting I would, because it's Scorsese and come on. But it was fine, but I didn't think the de-aging process was as good as some of the stuff I'd seen before.
Okay.
Although, having said that, I think that was more a case of it just being Robert De Niro's face. There was just something off. Just something off about it. I think Joe Pesci looked pretty good with the CGI. That was more believable somehow than De Niro. But it's cool. It's not worthy of a rant, so it's okay.
Well, De Niro does like wear like the pained expression of someone who knowingly participated in the making of Dirty Grandpa. So, you know.
Oh dear, I'd forgotten about that. I forget about so many of these films. That's the, like, wasn't the Johnny Knoxville involved with that?
Oh no, that's Bad Grandpa.
Oh, that's what I'm thinking of. So what's this one with De Niro? What?
Right. Well, Bad Grandpa is an Oscar-nominated film because of the prosthetics that Johnny Knoxville put on.
Right.
Dirty Grandpa is... Now, I haven't seen this film because the trailer is, like, morally irreprehensible, but it's basically this grandpa, played by Robert De Niro, and his grandson, played by Zac Efron, go on a road trip for no discernible reason, and Robert De Niro's like, I'm still old, but that 20-year-old in a bikini still makes me horny, and that's literally the joke.
Oh my god.
Oh, and Zac Efron's wife's an overbearing cow. I don't know.
God, why do they do that?
I don't know how that fits into the plot, but they felt necessary to put it in the trailer, so...
This is so off topic, but the film The Other Guys.
Oh yeah.
The one I mean with Mark Wahlberg and Will Ferrell.
Yeah.
I think it's great. It's really funny, but the character of the wife of I've just said his name and I've forgotten it.
Marky Mark?
Will Ferrell. The woman that plays Will Ferrell's wife.
Yeah.
I want to say Eva Mendes, is that right?
I mean, she's a person. She exists.
Have you seen it?
I haven't. I've heard it's good. The presence of Mark Wahlberg puts me off a bit, but I have been meaning to watch it.
It is Eva Mendes. I just looked it up. She plays Will Ferrell's wife, and for some reason, they play the joke of her being the most lovely wife in the world, but yeah. Will Ferrell treats her like shit and shouts at her and berates her and acts like she's just the worst thing in the world. And that's the joke.
Right.
And it sucks. And I could forgive it the first time I saw it. I was like, that's kind of shitty, but okay. And then the second time I watched it, I was like, man, I really don't like this bit of the film. Like, this really pisses me off. And even though I own it on DVD, whenever I think, oh, I might watch that, I never do, because I'm reminded of this big extended joke of her being just a lovely, loving, giving, caring wife and him shitting all over her. It's horrible.
Oh.
And that just reminded me.
Okay.
So there you go. Can't quite remember why I decided to bring that into the story, but... is what it is.
I mean, let's not try and trace this back to the source, because it stemmed somehow from Julianne Moore screaming, so...
Oh, that's right, yes. The most unstructured podcast ever. To anyone who's listening who actually gives, you know, who actually cares about Maps to the Stars, I hope you're still listening. I know we've veered off topic, but I don't know what to tell you. It is what it is.
It's a hard film to talk about, but we liked it.
But I like it. I like its themes. I like the actors in it. I like the storyline. I like the way it's shot, because it's beautiful. Yeah, I really enjoyed it. I don't know that it's one that I would necessarily recommend to everyone.
No, yeah, it's...
You've kind of got to, you got to have a feel for the person that you're going to recommend it to.
Yeah. Do you like Cronenberg? Do you like incest? Cool. Watch this film.
Kind of, yeah. Yeah. I don't know what we've just admitted about ourselves there, but...
Look, I'm not a committed incest fan. I've never been to any of the conventions. No. So.
Oh, you're missing out. Oh, no, I shouldn't joke. Not on a podcast. This isn't my living room. You can't make off-color jokes.
You say that, but I'm not editing that out, so...
Wonderful. Yeah, so... I'm at the risk of going off onto another tangent, I really don't think there's much more that I have to say about Maps to the Stars.
I don't either, to be honest. I've been struggling for most of this episode. I do like it a lot, but it's so hard to talk about.
It kind of is, unless you're talking to somebody who's already seen it, and obviously we've both seen it, but the lovely folks at home, all seven of you, they might not have seen Maps to the Stars. And although why they'd still be listening, I don't know.
Well, if it's any consolation, we've been running for an hour 23 and we've only talked about it for roughly 10 minutes, so I think they'll be fine.
Wow. Okay. So for a film that, yeah, we've only talked about for about 10 minutes, that's quite the podcast. And we've pissed off a lot of people.
Oh, yeah. Seriously, though.
People.
Five Nights at Freddy's fans, it's an animatronic chicken. Don't whack off to it.
What? I've never even heard of this. Is it a game, did you say?
Yeah, it's a game. The first one came out and it was like an instant hit because it was a very low budget horror game in which you're stuck in a room and you play a security guard at a like Chuck E. Cheese style restaurant, and the animatronics come alive at night and will try and kill you.
Okay.
And it is very good, and it achieves a level of terror that most like AAA horror games can't do. So they did a sequel which was set in a different time period, so the designs of the animatronics changed.
Right.
And the chicken mascot, they did this design which was basically, it was all the designs were like smooth.
Right.
So you had this very smooth down chicken thing that people temporarily had the hots for.
Good grief.
Yeah, that's why I stay away from certain fandoms.
They're even not if they're trusted.
Yeah, even if it's a fandom of a thing I like.
Yeah. Yeah, I know what you mean. It's obviously it's fine to love what you love, but I think there's something about fandoms that just is inherently a bit toxic.
Yeah.
So I tend to avoid them as well.
Yeah. Well, shall we do the obligatory stupid part of our podcast and give it a star rating?
Oh, this again. out of 5, isn't it? Or is it out of 10? I can't remember.
It's a 5.
Oh, 5 is so difficult. 10 is better. I've got more room to move around with 10. I would give Maps to the Stars. I would give it a 4. Don't ask me to justify it. yeah, I think a 4 is fine. I think it's good. Yeah, I enjoyed it. I would recommend it to certain people. Yeah, 4 out of 5.
Okay. I would also give it a 4 out of 5. No arguments this week.
Well, there you go. So 2 4 out of fives would be equal to an 8 out of 10, which is a bloody good score.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. So let's tell the good folks at home what we're going to discuss next week.
Okay, I hope I get this right. Was it the film you watched today?
Yes.
Don't say like that. Next.
Oh, it's going to be interesting.
Next episode, we will be doing the Disney classic. Don't even stop it.
bold words.
We are going to be reviewing a superhero film made by Disney before Disney had bought Marvel. Sky High. That's what we're reviewing next time, so look forward to that.
Oh, people are going to have to tune in because I watched it. That's all I'm going to say. It's not that bad. It'll be fine. It'll be fun. The folks at home are just dying to know what we think about Sky High. So let's give it to them.
Okay. Well, tune in next week for that. Yeah. Well, I've been David.
And I've been Moxie.
And we'll see you next time.
Bye-bye.
Bye.